Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, in the face of mass extinction, scientists are exploring bringing back some species from the dead.
And first,
the underworld of organ trafficking. The World Health Organization estimates that illegal organ traffickers obtain about 7,000 kidneys per year. The victims are often among the poorest people in the world, who either sell organs to get by or are murdered for them. Nancy Shepherd Hughes joins us. She is a professor of anthropology at the University of California, Berkeley. Her books include Commodifying Bodies and Violence in War and Peace, an anthology. We're also joined by award-winning bioethicist Art Kaplan. He is director of the Center for Bioethics at University of Pennsylvania and editor of books, including Smart Mice, Not So Smart People. Nancy Shepherd Hughes, how prevalent is this? Where are the illegal activities happening, and what more do we know?
Well, we know a lot. The landscape changes year to year because it is an underground economy. It's a shadow economy, and it opens up in one country. Police get alerted, and the people move on, and, they find another place to operate. But there are some places where it's very, very entrenched, and, you know, in this trade in organs, you have what I basically following some of the trafficking literature. You've got donor countries where people are recruited to sell, and you've got recipient countries or areas where people are inclined to need to travel to get a transplant. And then you have facilitating countries, and that's where the operations take place. In some cases, everything happens in one country, in other places within two. So, I mean, where is it? It's in South Asia. It's Southeast Asia. It's in the Middle East. It's in the United States. It's in Latin America. The Philippines, India, Pakistan, Egypt are, you know, places where this has really become quite entrenched. China, but in each place it's somewhat different. You know, China was using executed prisoners. They got in trouble for that. They passed some laws. Now it's moved to living paid donors, and that's not a good option. It's a hard thing to get the world together on in order to police it properly and to make sure that the worst, most egregious brokers and outlaw surgeons are stopped and prevented. But they seem to be very mobile. They seem to be ahead of the police all the time, and they just move from place to place.
I just heard you say outlaw surgeons.
Yeah, they're outlaws because they're willing to break existing laws in the countries where they're operating. Although I understand that the laws are sometimes a bit murky, most countries that do transplants do have pre-existing older laws that say commerce in tissues and organs is illegal. But often the exact standards, the exact penalty for doing this might be vague. In some countries, it's clearly explicit that you can't sell, but it doesn't say anything about can you buy an organ. So, yeah, there are some loopholes. But in general, organs trafficking is, and human trafficking for organs is covered under the UN Convention, what's commonly called the Palermo Convention, and certainly by most of the existing regulations within international transplant.
The gentleman that was arrested was running a trafficking ring.
Or Rabbi Rosenbaum.
He had been engaged in this for about 10 years. You had alerted FBI, I think, 7 years before they did anything.
Yeah.
How prevalent is this organ trafficking in the United States?
Well, it takes, in the United States, different forms. Isaac Rosenbaum was linked to a network that was operating globally, but through key brokers, or really criminal businessmen in Israel. So he was part of this very extensive network that moved people around from Israel to Turkey to Moldova to the Ukraine, Romania to Baku and Azerbaijan to the United States, where they operated in Brooklyn and in Philadelphia and in Maryland and in California, in Los Angeles. So that was one particular network, but there are others. Within India, there's a network in which primarily wealthy Indians, especially diasporic Indians living abroad, go back to India and get transplanted. Lots and lots of people in Asia go to the Philippines. The Philippines is a key site for kidney selling and buying. And a lot of people in the sort of Gulf states and in the Middle East go to Egypt. Iraq, before the war, was a major area for buying and selling organs.
Let's bring Art Kaplan in. There are multiple ethical issues that are tied up in this organ trade. One is the need for organs. One is people who are selling them are in dire enough straits that they're willing to sell parts of their bodily integrity. And the confidentiality between physicians and their patients. How do we address these ethical issues?
Well, there is tremendous need, and Nancy's given a rather sad and accurate picture about the extent to which a black market evolves among particularly poor nations and poor countries to meet that need. But it doesn't really meet the need in a systematic way. What you have is countries, they're not getting organs, and we're talking primarily here about kidneys when we're talking about buying and selling things. They don't have organs coming from cadavers, from the dead, as we do in the United States. They don't develop that system. Their incentive to do it is somewhat lessened. If they think locally they can buy an organ or a kidney from a poor person, they don't do it. You find around the world transplant centers winking and nodding, not doing very intensive interviews because of people who come and say, yes, I want to donate my kidney to my good friend. I think her name is Nancy, my good friend. So they're not checking to see whether I actually know Nancy or cousin as I claim. But, you know, good enough, I'm here and let's go. Their orientation of the transplant centers is to get organs to the people who need them. They make money doing that. They save lives doing that. They're not oriented toward the donors or sellers in the case of this black market situation. So they don't have representation. They don't have voices. They tend to be the ones exploited. I don't think this is the solution. And I would add, when you really start looking at the issue of poor people, and some would say, well, you know, they can make some money, they're poor, this is helpful. What we found in a study that I headed up for the United Nations and the Council of Europe on organ trafficking was that people don't work their way out of poverty by selling a kidney. The most desperate people sell. People have no other options, no work. It's a one-shot deal. They pay off a debt, and they're back in poverty again. If you wanted to say, well, maybe this market does some good for them, it really doesn't bring them any sort of economic benefit or boon. And the middlemen who handle this trade exploit them, rip them off for costs of travel, food, everything you can think of. They're charging these poor souls, so they don't really come out ahead. It's not a situation where they're coming out better than they were because they sold a kidney.
As I understand it, the United States is lagging from some of the other nations in dealing with the issues of the organ trafficking. Nancy, perhaps you can address this first.
To the extent that we have codes of confidentiality between doctors and patients, and there's a reluctance for the hospital nephrologist or the transplant coordinator or the committee that's in charge of really seeing that the law, NOTA, which our law against buying and selling organs, is being followed. And so the questioning is minimalist. And when I've found hospitals where there has been some consensual buying and selling where people find each other online, but also in New York City when Isaac Rosenbaum was working and some of his associates in the Philadelphia area, they actually did bring in people who were trafficked. They may have initially agreed, but they got to the States and they wanted to get out. And I had a person from Isaac Rosenbaum's network call me and say, I need to get out of this because we're forcing people to do this. I don't mind if people want to buy and sell, but we've had people coming from poor countries. We have Ukrainians, Moldovans, poor Israelis that are coming here. They're getting frightened and they're being told that they have to get up on a table and sell. Now, the fact that the hospitals failed to catch that can only be that there was really a lack of due diligence. If people can't speak the same language, if they seem frightened of each other, if there seems to be a hesitancy. Well, I can tell you that in Europe, I spoke at the House of Lords with a group of very informed experts about how you really regulate this. And in the UK, they said, we have no problem with investigating. And we don't say, oh, we're policing, or we don't say, oh, we become, you know, immigration offices. Basically, if somebody says they're related, we say, oh, well, show us some proof that you're related. So they really do ask for proof, and I've never run into a medical center in the United States where that is customary. I don't know, maybe Art has found that.
Very few, unfortunately, and it's the most simple thing. You'd think they'd want to establish
right
identity, and Very few do. Very few. And again, it's partly because I think they are oriented towards saying, let's get the kidney for the people that need them, and we can make money if we put them in. We need kidneys. We got a lot of capacity to do operations. It's very lucrative. Yeah. We're not oriented, I'm talking for the transplant team now, toward detection of donor benefit and interest.
Thank you so much. Nancy Shepherd Hughes is a professor of anthropology at the University of California, Berkeley. Her books include Commodifying Bodies and Violence in War and Peace, an anthology. Art Kaplan is director of the Center for Bioethics at University of Pennsylvania and editor of books, including Smart Mice and Not So Smart People. When we come back, in the face of mass extinction, scientists are exploring bringing back some species from the dead. Stay tuned.
To understand the shore, it is not enough to catalog its life. Understanding comes only when, standing on a beach, we can sense the long rhythms of earth and sea that sculptured its landform and produced the rock and sand of which it is composed. When we can sense with the eye and ear of the mind the surge of life beating always at its shores, blindly, inexorably, pressing for a foothold. To understand the life of the shore, it is not enough to pick up an empty shell and say, this is a murex, or that is an angel wing. True understanding demands intuitive comprehension of the whole life of the creature that once inhabited this empty shell. How it survived amid surf and storms, what were its enemies, how it found food and reproduced its kind, what were its relations to the particular sea world in which it lived.
Ecologist, scientist, and author Rachel Carson from Pacifica Radio Archives Environment Series.
Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In the face of mass extinction, scientists are exploring bringing back some species from the dead. Their ability to do so raises all sorts of both ethical and practical issues. We're joined now by three scientists who are all experts in the field of de-extinction to help us understand the phenomenon and all of the concerns that arise with it. Michael Archer is a professor in the School of Biological Earth and Environmental Sciences at the University of New South Wales. He's the author of Prehistoric Mammals of Australia and New Guinea and From Plesiosaurs to People, 100 Million Years of Australian Environmental History. Douglas McCauley is a professor in the Department of Ecology, Evolution, and Marine Biology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. His papers include Megafaunal Impacts on Structure and Function of Ocean Ecosystems, Marine Defaunation, Animal Loss in the Global Oceans, Resetting Predator Baselines in Coral Reef Ecosystems. Susan Haig also joins us. She's a senior scientist at the U.S. Geological Survey Forest and Rangeland Ecosystem Science Center, and she's courtesy professor of wildlife ecology at Oregon State University. Her papers include The Conservation Genetics Juggling Act, Integrating Genetics and Ecology, Science and Policy, and Ancient DNA Reveals Substantial Genetic Diversity in the California Condor. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have the three of you here with us on such a fascinating subject, the idea of bringing species back from extinction, a process we're calling de-extinction. So I thought the best place to start is why we even have to consider de-extinction. What is going on in our world? Susan Haig, maybe that's your start. What are we facing?
Oh, the world is facing unprecedented levels of extinction rates at this moment in geological time. There's never been a time in history where we've lost so many species at such a rapid rate. So I think that that has spurred on people to be concerned. And with the advent of new technology, it is amazing what we can accomplish now with trying to bring species back. So I think the combination of the two has really set the stage for what is turning out to be a bit of a scientific revolution, actually.
I think it was in Nature, you wrote a piece laying out what it means when we lose certain species and what's behind them all. For example, the natural environment, what it provides for us, food, water, energy, medicine, and yet we have a growing population. How would you describe that?
In terms of what happens when we lose a species?
Yeah, and how many places we might be facing this?
Well, there's species extinctions occurring, unfortunately, in every part of the world. Climate change, human overpopulation, et cetera, is causing a lot of species to go extinct. And of course, there are natural extinctions. And I think that what happens is, first of all, we don't know of all the species that went extinct or are going extinct because we don't really have worldwide surveys of all, even the largest mammals you can think of. So we don't know as much as is happening, but by the same token, what we do know is really startling. And so I think that you can only imagine that if it can be catastrophic to lose one species in an ecosystem. For instance, if you take the big experiment, actually, is in Yellowstone National Park in Montana and Wyoming in the U.S., where the big mammals were taken out. So the wolves and the bears were taken out, and it just wreaked havoc in terms of the habitat changed and the other species that had been prey animals to those species actually did worse without the predators, because the predators helped keep their numbers in check. And also those animals, when they thrive, they kept the habitat in check. So it can be sort of a cascading effect of even just losing one species.
One of the things that you had noted in that article is how it affects us, too, because we rely on the ecosystem for so many aspects of humanity, whether it's food or water or medicine.
Oh, exactly. And the other thing is, just think of climate change and the fact that we're so close to losing polar bears. I think that these species that are going extinct are an indication of the status of our world right now. And that in itself is a message. But it's just difficult to, I guess I'm having a hard time trying to quantify what it means to lose a species, because, you know, you can always argue, oh, you lost the spider, who cares? But in the long run, it is a big part of an ecosystem that really we often don't even know the complete consequences of what happens when we lose them.
Michael Archer, what would you add?
Where do we start? We're in the middle of a terrible disaster. I mean, we've had 5 mass extinctions on the planet already and many smaller ones. But as Susan said, this current one that's unfolding, which is now sort of described as the 6th mass extinction of the world, is just happening so fast that the resilience of life to be able to respond and recover from this has been ripped away from it. Besides, we've, of course, particulated the world up into little squares of surrounding everything with agriculture. The resilience of the world is gone to even be able to respond in the way that it did previously to mass extinction. So we do have a problem. And I think for me, and I think for many of us, we're saying it's time to take the gloves off. We've got to stop being so concerned about preservation, trying to keep the world the way it is, because that's just not going to happen anymore. And that means all of these new technologies have got to be on the table, and we've got to be fairly aggressively determined to be willing to consider every strategy that could optimize or at least reduce the losses of global biodiversity. We don't know what we're losing or what critical factors here are going to disappear that are going to be very important for our own survival into the future. So I think de-extinction is one of the powerful new tools that not only helps us optimize biodiversity, but it also provides us with new technologies that should help us slow down the loss of species that are occurring in the world right now. It's not just about bringing extinct things back. It's also about learning technologies that will help us conserve endangered species today.
Douglas McCauley.
Yeah, I think some really great thoughts in circulation here, painting a picture for what's happening around us by Michael and Susan. I think just this idea that we are accelerating towards a 6th mass extinction really helps us understand the magnitude of this event. I mean, we have some of these past historical mass extinction, to put things in perspective, are events like when a 10-kilometer asteroid hit the planet with the force of, you know, hundreds of thousands more nuclear bombs, right? And that's the event that drove the dinosaurs extinct. This is what we're sort of talking about now happening in real time on our planet, that we are now the new asteroid, and we're altering our planet in so many different ways, as we've mentioned, that are pushing species right to the brink of extinction and pushing many of them over that edge directly to extinction. I think your question was spot on as well about what does this matter? Well, certainly it matters to lose camaraderie that is biodiversity has been on our planet for millions of years. You know, these are really special parts of planet Earth, right? These are lineages that are old, that are beautiful, that are special, that are complex. But it's not just about losing these amazing species and ecosystems. It's about losing what they do for us. Sometimes we don't know what it is, but in many cases we do. And they provide us with nutritious dinners. They provide us with clean water. They're there in the case, for example, of coral reefs, protecting our coastlines and coastal homes from storm damage. It is both a selfless and a selfish exercise to begin to get our heads around what this begin at the beginnings of the sixth mass extinction mean to our planet, and importantly, what they mean to us.
So let's look now at what has developed in the field. Michael Archer, you were on with us maybe 2 years ago when we first started discussing this on this program. What's happening in the field of de-extinction? What has shifted over the last few years?
It's very interesting, actually. I think as we see global interest in the potential benefits of going down this path, there's been a massive increase in consideration of what species should we be thinking about possibly bringing back from that brink of extinction. And I think there are about six projects at the moment that are active. There's certainly the woolly mammoth project, there's the passenger pigeon, the heath hen, the quagga, there's aurochs. We're working on the gastric brooding frog, and then there's a lot of other related projects. A lot of these being managed by Revive and Restore, I might add. It's an amazing organization that is helping to support a lot of this happening. Much of it also, I would add, involving funding that has nothing to do with funding that would otherwise be looking after endangered living species. In almost all cases, it's new money coming from people interested in the technology and the possibilities it could bring. These projects are not moving ahead at the expense of conventional conservation of other endangered species. And in fact, you know, I would reiterate, I think a lot of the technology that's coming out of these existing projects is going to be extremely important in helping us to better look after things that are endangered today. It's a synergistic thing. I mean, in many ways, it's a bit like playing a game of golf. If you're setting out to do more effective conservation, and you have one club in your bag, you're just not going to play a particularly good game. And I think de-extinction, translocations, genetic modification, a whole range of strategies are now available that can better enable us to look after the things we don't want to lose any more of. But these current projects, I think, hopefully will be the incentive to consider others as well. So while only six projects are moving forward fairly aggressively at this point, I'd like to think that, you know, with success of one of these, remember, we haven't actually succeeded yet. There's a lot of efforts going on here. So a lot of the excitement about whether we should or shouldn't be trying these sorts of things is a tiny bit premature. Let's see if we can do one of these first. And then if it is successful, then we start saying, well, how should we refocus this effort and really try to get back key species that are going to make a big difference to the condition of the world?
I remember reading about bringing back a particular kind of goat back in, I think, 2003, but it just really died off again. Is this something that we're going to be dealing with?
That was a complex situation. I was so excited about that project. I think most of us were, because it was, in fact, technically the first time an extinct animal managed to get born. It didn't survive, but then so do many goats that are born. They have the same sorts of problems. So it's not clear it had anything to do with the de-extincting process. But that particular project didn't move ahead, not because the cloning involved or the use of ancient DNA in that sense wasn't successful. It stopped because there wasn't a coordination with the local Spanish government to keep that environmental place. The Bucardo, and that was the name of this kind of goat, was going to be put back into the environment to restore that bit of biodiversity and that ecosystem stability. So the Spanish government instead allowed a different goat to be introduced to the same area, making it kind of pointless to try to get the extinct animal back because its habitat had been taken away. So there are all sorts of issues here that have to be considered, not just about the biology and the technology of the process, but about what are you going to do when you get the animal back? Have we got all the other aspects of these projects worked out?
Were there others like this?
You mean like the Bucardo, like that project?
Yeah.
That was the most advanced one in terms of doing, if you like, classic cloning involving trans species shifting of the nucleus from one cell of one species into the cell of another. The same kind of project is the one that we're working on now with the gastric brooding frog. You'll often hear people say, well, okay, the woolly mammoth, if we get it back, it won't be exactly a woolly mammoth because it'll be a blend of Asiatic elephant genes as well as the recovered woolly mammoth gene. So it'll be kind of a mixed animal, but it may be functionally serving the role of a mammoth and helping suppress the release of greenhouse gases in Siberia. So it's still extremely important. In the case of the gastric brooding frog, we are doing something very similar to the Bucardo project because we're taking whole nuclei that were frozen 40 years ago. So we're not playing with the genetics of the animal at all. We're moving the whole of its genome into the egg cell of a different species. So what we would expect to get out of the embryos that we're already getting and now trying to encourage to continue to develop should be an entirely intact gastric brooding frog. It's not going to be a hybrid animal. So there's a blend of different kinds of de-extinction projects going on, some of which will have the whole genome back, some of which will have a mixed genome.
So how do we choose which animals or other species that we do want to bring back? Douglas McCauley, I know you and Susan Haig have both looked at this. Why don't you start?
Let me lay my cards on the table. I admire the science that Michael and Susan have underway. I'm a little bit more conservative about where I think we can and should be making the biggest impact with this science. I think as a conservation biologist, everyone here, we all agree that we're up against something serious, that with the acceleration of extinction rates, with us looking down the barrel at a forthcoming sixth mass extinction, you put it well, Michael, we want to have our golf bag, if you will, filled with as many clubs as we can. And we're scientists, right? So we don't want to be Luddites. We want to be looking for best technologies. But I think we need to be thinking very thoughtfully about strategically where de-extinction will work and where it won't work, which sort of brings us back to your question. You know, I think one of the things that if we are going forward with de-extinction is thinking carefully about bringing back functions. So I think, Michael, you touched on a few things that it's one part of the process to actually, if you will, bring a species back from the dead. It's probably the more important part of the process from the point of view of an ecologist, a scientist, a conservation biologist, is making that species stick, right? Making sure it goes back to the same abundances, to the same jobs, the same functions that it once served. So that starts with a selection process. You want to choose a species for which there's a space still in the ecosystem to bring back. I'm going to choose a species that has a function that's gone totally missing. If there's a lot of species out there that are still alive, still extant, and are essentially replicating the function of that extinct species, maybe that's not a good choice. Another important decision, and maybe the last criteria I'll throw in the mix, is in order to maybe get closer to some of these aims about trying to reintroduce a species successfully, we can win some of those battles and actually overcome some of the technological challenges with the extinction by choosing younger extinctions. Michael, for example, is working your gastric brooding frog, which absolutely fits the bill of what I was talking about in terms of complexity and wonder, just such an amazing animal and such a loss from our planet. It's also a relatively young extinction. You can speak to this much better than I can, but the challenges for doing at least the brand of and the breed of de-extinction science that you're doing are much more tractable. Of course, a major scientific undertaking, but much more tractable when we're talking about younger extinctions. And then also when you're trying to bring a species like a gastric brooding frog or something that just went extinct back into an ecosystem, your likelihood of being successful is going to be much greater if there's still that space open for it. If the frog, the pigeon, the mammoth needed something like a forest and that particular forest is gone, well, you know, then it's perhaps not so wise to bring that species back from the dead. And that the probability of something key going missing in the ecosystem that you want to recover the species increases as the date of extinction gets longer, as the extinction is older.
Susan Haig.
There's so many points to think about that you've brought up about this. I think one thing that came to mind, this young extinction idea is obviously really important. And actually, maybe one example that's turning out to be great is Ollie Ryder at the San Diego Zoo long ago had the foresight to save ferns from black-footed ferrets. And now black-footed ferrets have gone through yet another bottleneck and they've got issues with distemper and they have inbreeding depression. And yet now Ollie has this sperm from the past that he can use for artificial insemination. So the ferrets that are on the brink now, but are hanging on, the females are being inseminated with genetic material that is far healthier than what they would be injected or what they would be inseminated with had they just been mating with the other ferrets that are extant at the moment. So that's not necessarily a high-tech example, but it shows that, you know, having some foresight and using some technology before species go extinct really helps. Another point I wanted to bring up, though, is when we think about de-extinction and the benefits, I don't think we have to jump from, oh, we lost the woolly mammoths, to, oh, we need the woolly mammoths back. I think it's kind of like the space program in the 60s, where there are so many ancillary benefits to conservation that are coming from scientists focusing their efforts at the extinction process that it is truly remarkable. There are a number of species that are benefiting tremendously as a result of genetic engineering. They're not species that are going extinct. They're species that are making other species go extinct. For example, now through genetic engineering, we're able to, not me, but others are able to produce reassembled herpes virus in Asian elephants so that now vaccine can be developed and it's doing miracles to save Asian elephants. I work on islands in the Marianas Islands and the brown tree snake has been just, and as many people know, introduced rodents have been the bane of trying to conserve many islands. But now invasive rodents can be eradicated by just translocating a gene from one rodent into the testes. There can be gene translocation, And what happens is it as it passes on, you are only creating male offspring so that ultimately you end up with all male offspring on an island and they go extinct, which is pretty amazing. They're editing resistance genes for Lyme disease so that that can be gotten rid of. And maybe the one that's really near and dear to my heart is avian malaria. It's terrible, but it's most pronounced in the Hawaiian Islands where all these bird species have gone extinct. They're now able to release mosquitoes that have dominant lethal gene, which basically is causing their extinction. I view the progress in incremental stages, I guess is the bottom line. I don't think we have to wait for a woolly mammoth before we can see tremendous benefits from this technology being progressed and developed.
Well, I think this is also really important that it doesn't have to be, you know, bringing back that specific species, but there are all of these ways that maybe can be helped or can help what is happening. One of the issues I had been thinking about is, you know, suppose we bring a species back, but their habitat is not really a condition for them to live anymore. They can't survive in that habitat. Climate change has become such that a species can't function. What do we do about these situations? And is it feasible then to bring a species back when it won't be able to survive? That's a Michael Archer question.
I have to say, of all the projects that I'm aware of that people are actually focused on with de-extinction, and as well as working on the endangered species, the habitats actually still are there. In the case of the gastric brooding frog, for us, the rainforest is still there, and so on. And of course, there's now Pleistocene Park has been established in Siberia with all kinds of fascinating reasons why it should be possible to get mammoths back onto Siberia and doing all sorts of good things. But I think we maybe need to lighten up a bit about this as well. I'm not a great fan of thinking that if you can't maintain a species in its original habitat, that it's functionally extinct anyway. I don't buy this in some ways, because I think even if you hit a situation like that, for example, another project I've been working on in the past was the thylacine or Tasmanian tiger project. I've been in the habitats in Tasmania where the animal lived, and they are certainly still capable of getting thylacines back. I wouldn't stop at that. I wouldn't say that that is the ultimate criterion for whether or not you bring an animal back, because I also know that, that Tasmanian tigers were being kept as pets by people in the 1800s. It was illegal because they had declared them to be pests and were trying to destroy them all. But in fact, if it had been allowed to occur, they would still be in the world today. And I think that a plethora of strategies for looking after important distinctive parts of the global genome are things we should consider, not just releasing them into the wild, but also taking other steps to ensure that the genomes survive. And in some cases, frankly, that might even be in zoos, it might be in breeding facilities, because we just don't know how important those genomes are. And I wouldn't even stop with the idea that we should only think about putting them back into their original habitat. I'm a paleontologist. In some cases, I'm discovering that where living animals that are endangered today are struggling to survive, there are adjacent habitats that you would never have thought about, but the fossil record tells you they used to live in those areas. I'm inclined to think we should be exploring the possibility of translocating animals into habitats where they don't occur today, but where we have some indication they're likely to be able to survive and maybe increase the global functional biodiversity of those ecosystems. In New Zealand, for example, the takahi, which is the largest land whale in the world, is in an alpine area, and it was struggling to survive. It was down to only a handful of individuals before somebody in New Zealand said, hey, weren't there bones of this bird, this unique bird, in the lowlands of New Zealand? What if we try to translate some of these alpine individuals down into the lowlands? And everybody said it had never worked. There are different foods, et cetera, et cetera. But they tried it anyway, and it worked wonderfully. The takahi love lawn grass, and they started building up numbers and became fat little happy birds. And now they're putting more of those birds back into the alpine zone. So I think we really need to take the lid off the whole range of things we might speculate about here, because there are many ways to get good outcomes that aren't necessarily about preserving the existing situation we see on the Earth today.
Just a reminder that you're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudin, and we're talking about de-extinction, bringing extinct species back from the dead. I know there are ethical issues that get raised when we talk about things like de-extinction. And Michael, I know that you argue on one side of this that it is ethical because we have done an unethical thing by driving these to extinction. What are the counter arguments? Douglas McCauley, can you speak to those?
Sure. It would be great to also feed back a little bit on some of the points that Michael laid out, which I think are good. With all due respect to your opinions, Michael, which I think are quite sound, I have a very difficult time lightening up on the issue about extinction. As we laid out, we're looking at perhaps the biggest catastrophe for biodiversity on our planet. That's affecting what is history, richness, beauty, complexity of life around us. And if we're seeing us sort of accelerate toward the sixth mass extinction, there's nothing really, to me, that I see in that biological future that leaves me with a sense of levity. What I see is an ambitious task, but the ambitious task for us is not in the lab trying to create oddities or points of curiosity that would populate zoos. What I see is the most ambitious task that scientists and conservation biologists are facing today is to try to stem this flow of extinction. And so I think there could be a role for de-extinction in thinking strategically about how to intervene in this global biodiversity catastrophe, because as we've said, it matters for the planet around us, and it matters for us. But I think we need to be very careful about what we're doing with this talent, with the IQ, with the tools we have in our labs, because so much more needs to be done and so much more should be done than simply creating more exciting zoos, more exciting pets. In terms of the morality associated with this, I think we're getting into new space here. And of course, we're getting to this space in all elements of science, at least in how we're pushing the envelope for genetics and genetic research. You know, we're talking essentially about nothing less than playing God. You know, what we're looking at here is a set of tools that are truly and literally helping us to bring back species in their entirety from the dead, or to make kind of zombies, mixed up portions of different kinds of dead species. That's a new power that we never had before. Of course, we're still using these exact same kinds of tools in other contexts to help cure diseases in human health. We're getting into some interesting space here, I think, in what conservation biologists can do and should do. I think it's worth, you know, as we get more of these powers sort of laid out in front of us on our lab benches, be careful about how we apply them.
Can I just sneak in a little comment there? Just to be a tiny bit mischievous, because you should never trust professors quoting the Bible. But when we say about, you know, this is humans playing God, it actually bothers me a bit that we need to remember what it says in 1 Corinthians 15:26, that the last enemy that shall be destroyed is death. I mean, it's kind of like God's message to humans. Well, we messed up the Garden of Eden. Now it's our job to get rid of death, because that's the enemy of life. And I don't see that de-extinction couldn't be seen in this light. It's actually an effort to try to find a way to reverse the things that we've messed up. I do agree with a lot of the things that Douglas has said. It's just that I think that while the first effort should be to try to keep things as healthy as we can in the world today, the reality is the world's changing. It's been changing for the last 3.5 billion years, and it will continue to change we're a change factor and we're making a real mess of things. And in the face of all of this change, I just think that we have to take a deep breath and say things can't be kept the way they were because the world is changing and we're changing it. We have to look for a whole range of potential alternative strategies to keep as much of the things that are important in life, and in particular, the capacity of life to evolve new life forms into the future. So we need to preserve the capacity for change. We have to try to avoid getting trapped in the idea that our main goal here is preservation of the existing situation, because that's getting increasingly impossible.
It didn't sound to me like that was the argument that Doug was saying. I think he was saying that there's a very big toolbox and that this is one of the tools in it. But I think the other piece that is in the background of what Doug had said is, could these things go horribly wrong? And, you know, maybe we should bring Susan Haig back into this as well. Susan Haig, what do you say to this ethical argument? Could things go horribly badly?
There's always a chance they can genetically engineer mosquito that takes out something. Someone could do something terrible for, you know, propagating a disease. But in more practicality, several things. I think one is it's going to be a long period of time before we can actually produce populations of individuals of a species. I guess I'm not so worried about that. I would say that, amazingly enough, the IUCN, the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, that produces the world's red list, which is the world's endangered species list, they have already come up with criteria for de-extinction. They've taken this very seriously, and already they've said, okay, you know, we think that these criteria must be met, and they actually have a red list of species to de-extinct, which I found fairly shocking. But I'm looking at this list, there must be 30 species on this list that they have deemed appropriate according to their actions. So I think that in some ways it's comforting that a world-renowned organization is paying attention to this. On the other hand, I just don't see it being a problem that quickly. What I do think is an interesting issue, I don't know if it's problematic or not, but I know that, for instance, there are labs in the U.S. that are receiving huge amounts of money for bringing back, for example, a falcon that's valuable for falcons. And I guess the question is, what happens then? If you have enough money, do you have the right to bring something back or not? Because it's not that this thing is going to live in your basement. It's that if you're really going to do it, you're going to be releasing it out into the wild. And to me, I don't see that as an immediate question, but I think that is an ethical issue that is going to be before us before there's ever a problem with this species coming back from the wild and, you know, taking over the earth.
Doug McCauley, do you have a response to that?
We really are breaking new ground here in an exciting way. And so I think there are going to be a lot of uncertainties about what happens. You know, to be honest, my concern is less about cranking something out of the lab, a mammoth or passenger pigeon or frog or whatever it is, that it hits the ground and explodes in number and takes off in a way that takes over our planet. I'm actually much more concerned about the opposite, that we build something in the lab, a new species, and we have a really hard time, almost impossible time, getting these things back into ecosystems. And to me, that'll be really concerned. I mean, we talked about some of the barriers to bringing species back. I mean, I think there are a couple of cases now that leave me with a little bit of concern about capacity. So to have things go the other direction, where we end up with having manufactured a handful of these new species and they have no home. So the passenger pigeon is an example of a species that there's quite a lot of effort and intellect and money being invested here in the U.S. and elsewhere, trying to bring this once extinct species back to life. Now, the passenger pigeon, you know, may have a very malleable ecology, a very plastic and changeable ecology, as Michael pointed out, some birds do. But it was heavily dependent, and its favorite food were American chestnuts. That's a kind of forest that, as a result of the chestnut blight, has gone almost entirely extinct in the United States. So we're looking at a major challenge trying to figure out, well, what's the new home of this new species? So to be honest, the thing that concerns me most is about not having too much success, but having too little success. And it, sort of connecting to that is cost. I think, you know, when we're looking at trying to be as strategic as we can, we have this huge problem that we're dealing with, which is this coming mass extinction. We have species that have crossed the line and extinct, and unfortunately we have many hundreds, thousands that are lining up right there on the edge of this extinction cliff. We have to make some pretty strategic decisions about where we're going to put our effort, where to put our money. So in terms of the currency of money, you know, there's been some recent work that's shown that actually projections for how we're going to bring these species that we make using de-extinction back into the wild is going to be extremely costly. In fact, much more costly if you sort of add up the dollars to save species than it would be if we tried to use more traditional tools in our conservation toolkit. The process, for example, of trying to bring a species all the way back to fruition out into the wild, doing its thing again as it once did, we would spend more money and in fact save less species than if we invested in some of these strategic methods for example, habitat or ecosystem conservation. And I think we just need to confront some of those challenges.
I have to rise to Douglas's challenge there a bit. And I read the paper too. A lot of us who are involved in de-extinction saw that challenge and saying that, in fact, we do more harm than good by bringing an extinct animal back. But that paper actually, I hate to say it, was very shallow in its overall take on the implications of bringing extinct species back. It didn't consider the possibility that bringing strategically selected species back could in fact provide greater protection for a wider range of species by getting it back into the world. Like, for example, bringing the thylacine back as an example, you're bringing back a keystone species, the dominant carnivore in Tasmania. You stop trophic cascades from taking out other species that might otherwise start to happen. So I think that paper, it was almost like it set out to be kind of negative. It's fair enough to have all kinds of arguments out there about the pluses and minuses of a new technology, but it wasn't a balanced paper. And in fact, a lot of us have wondered whether there shouldn't be a response to point out that if you really look at all the issues involved and the benefits you could get from de-extinction, including new technologies that'll help save endangered species, I think you'd find that the equation for whether it's a good or a bad thing would be at least evened out, if not on the positive side, by definitely using de-extinction. I would add, too, also about the passenger pigeon. You're quite right, Douglas, about the issue of the habitat that the passenger pigeon was particularly comforted by. But, you know, fascinatingly, one of the other de-extinction projects that's been involved, it's really about focused on endangered species, is one focused on the American chestnut. There's a whole group that's been working on getting the American chestnut back on its feet and resistant to the chestnut bite, and they're making massive strides. And the intention, of course, is to get American chestnuts back where they were and again restoring the balance of forests. There have been new papers coming out saying this is likely to be a successful effort. It will restore the biodiversity of the plant species in those forests. And hey, it just might provide that extra habitat for the passenger pigeon if and when that can be brought back.
I appreciate your points. And I think we can certainly agree, Michael, in as much that making projections for the cost of bringing a new and exciting technology online, there's a lot of uncertainties and there's going to be a lot of challenges in sort of nailing those numbers. I think it's just fair to say that we know it's going to be expensive. We need to think about the expenses on the front end of developing the species. We can't forget that it can be quite expensive to get them back in if our ambition, as many of ours is not about about trying to do grander things with the extinction than creating new pets. I think to the point of cost, to the point of strategic impact, we can potentially go back, and I would be very hopeful, be really excited to see a blight-resistant chestnut come back online. But I think it's fair to say, again, that if we consider thousands of species still alive, still around us, not yet extinct, that you know, you're on the forefront of this. It is not cheap to try to just simply bring a species, you've been working on this for years, not cheap to try to bring species like a gastric breeding frog back to life. It is not cheap to do conservation for an endangered species. But I think it's fair to say that when you have two of them jumping around in front of you in a forest, that the opportunities, the costs are lower than if you have to reach way back into a fragmented genome to try to put pieces back together to manufacture something. You actually have a lot more opportunity for investment and impact if you're starting with a species that are there around you to begin with.
Ironically, Douglas, I just got to pop in there again and say, actually, I'm not sure that's true, because, in fact, the cost of working on our gastric brooding frog, getting the DNA back, getting the embryos back again, has been less than the cost of employing one technician for 1 year. I mean, it's not that. It's the money.
Michael Archer, yeah. Let me just stop because I'd like to know when you say less than the cost of, give us some numbers. I read a number, and I think it was the paper you guys are talking about, that the cost of trying to bring back a bird, I think it was called the Chatham Bill bird, was like $360,000 for a year.
Well, in the case of the gastric brooding frog, I raised actually $100,000 from two people who were not supporting conservation projects. They're interested in the technology. As I say, it's completely new money that would never otherwise be available for conventional conservation. And I haven't used a fraction of that money to get us to the point where we're at now. So I think, you know, done carefully, these projects needn't be very expensive. But Douglas is quite right to say you've got to factor in the costs of looking after the species after you put it back in the environment. You know, what are the ongoing costs to ensure the successful reintroductions? So it is fair that to look at the totality of the costs involved in the projects, not just about bringing it back. But along the way, you've got these other benefits that are coming out of this kind of research that are, in a sense, free because the costs involved in doing the de-extincting are meeting those costs. But they're producing technological tools that are going to be useful, really useful tools to do other kinds of work involving conventional conservation. So it is a complex issue.
Susan Haig.
A final comment with this ethics discussion is I think the points both Michael and Douglas are making are really important. But I think the one, honestly, that scares me the most is the point that politicians will take the idea of de-extinction and use it to not fund conservation efforts in the field. And just kind of wave their hands and say, well, you know, the species can go extinct, we'll save it later, when there really is no later. And that is the thing that puts fear in my heart.
You know, it's interesting you would say that, too, because so much of what we get to do with science, whether it's my field in social science or your field in biological science, is dependent upon who are our representatives in government and whether or not our projects move forward in an ethical way.
Exactly. And that's my point. That's why it is, in my mind, a very scary aspect of this de-extinction argument. That doesn't mean I don't support it, because I do. It's just a fear I have.
Final comments, Michael Archer?
I think it's been a fascinating discussion, and thanks for coordinating this. A lot of the key issues that are sort of boiling topics for discussion within and beyond the de-extinction research groups have been touched on today. And I think that's very healthy. And I think, as Susan said, one of the important messages to all of us here is to make sure politicians who just, well, may not have the biological or ecological backgrounds to understand the implications of research of this kind and how it can benefit net conservation and biodiversity controls, to make sure they do understand that. And that means presenting publicly all the time, not sitting back in the laboratories and shutting the doors and hoping nobody's listening to what we're trying to do. We need to talk about it, because the benefits of this are things politicians must understand if they're not going to be obstacles on the way to the beneficial outcomes.
Doug McCauley.
I really appreciate the thoughts of the colleagues here and in circulation. I think what we share is common ground is absolutely that something needs to be done, that this problem has only been accelerating extinction. The extinction problem is getting worse and worse every day. And so we need to have thoughtful scientists and conservation biologists bringing old tools and new tools together, increasing the strength and the fervor which we put these to work. But I would say we want to do it intelligently. Just because we're able to, and this is what is exciting to me, is that I think Michael will be successful, and Susan's colleagues and Susan will be successful doing de-extinction. And that's exciting, but that's also something that I think we want to take a moment of pause and say, just because we can bring extinct species back, do we want to do it? And if we can, where do we want to do it with the greatest impact? Because really, to me, as somebody that looks out at the world and sees this rich matrix, the tapestry of life to which, you know, there are threads that come and go connecting us to it, and seeing that begin to unfold, What I want to do is sort of put that back together as best and as quickly and as with the most integrity as possible. And we need to be very thoughtful about how we bring de-extinction into this brand new toolkit for conservation biology to do this. I think it's really important. I would sort of amplify Susan's last point is that a very important thing about embracing de-extinction is ensuring that that doesn't take any of the edge off the severity and the consequence of driving a species extinct. You know, we're talking here about uncertain futures for being able to bring an extinct animal, a mammoth, a frog, put it back to life in an ecological life in an ecosystem. We're facing high costs trying to bring these species back to life. There certainly will be some species where we fail to de-extinct, right? So if anything, for me, it raises my awareness that extinction is significant, that it's serious, that it's probably the greatest travesty and damage that human can do to our planet. It's not something that we should be taking lightly. And so this technology, if anything, should help us realize just how serious a problem extinction is and how much more effort, much more thought, and how much more resources and heart we need to put on the table to deal with this issue.
Final word, Susan Haig.
Well, obviously the points Michael and Douglas made are incredibly important. And so instead of repeating them, I wanted to take it maybe just one step further and say, if we were to stop the research on de-extinction right now, which I do not support, but if we did, I think that we should be, as an ecologist and a conservation biologist, I cannot get over the fact that we might have avian malaria gone from the Hawaiian Islands. That is so beyond anything I thought could happen. Or truly getting rid of rodents on islands. I mean, these are monumental advances in conservation that 5 years ago we couldn't have imagined, and they're here. And so already the progress that's been made in science because people are addressing this issue has just catapulted us decades ahead of where we thought we might be in some of these efforts. It just points to how important it is that scientists be allowed to do science and take their results where they go and keep exploring. The exploratory mind is so important, and I hope that we always continue to have that sort of freedom to explore and to go where our research takes us.
Well, thank you so much, Michael Archer, Susan Haig, Douglas McCauley. It's been a great pleasure to host you. Thank you for sharing your research with us.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Maria.
Michael Archer is a professor in the School of Biological Earth and Environmental Sciences at the University of New South Wales. He's the author of Prehistoric Mammals of Australia and New Guinea and From Plesiosaurs to People, 100 Million Years of Australian Environmental History. Douglas McCauley is a professor in the Department of Ecology, Evolution, and Marine Biology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. His papers include Megafaunal Impacts on Structure and Function of Ocean Ecosystems, Marine Defaunation, Animal Loss in the Global Oceans, Resetting Predator Baselines in Coral Reef Ecosystems. Susan Haig's a senior scientist at the U.S. Geological Survey Forest and Rangeland Ecosystem Science Center, and she's courtesy professor of wildlife ecology at Oregon State University. Her papers include The Conservation Genetics Juggling Act, Integrating Genetics and Ecology, Science and Policy, and Ancient DNA Reveals Substantial Genetic Diversity in the California Condor.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.